We've heard the news from the BBC. Now it's your turn.
You can post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay
or get in touch via Twitter at @BBC_WHYS.
Welcome to World Have Your Say.
Hello, I'm Jill McGivering. Welcome to World Have Your Say. How threatened are you by cyber war? A lot of governments are worried. South Korea is the latest to announce that it's putting together a plan to protect itself from cyber attacks. The United States recently said it plans to treat cyber attacks as acts of war. And of course, businesses too are targeted. But how helpful is it to think of cyber attacks as being like wars? And should suicide be shown on television? Last night, the BBC broadcast a controversial documentary. It showed a terminally ill man being helped to end his own life. It sparked a lot of debate. Some people said it shouldn't have been shown. Others argue that it adds to debate about a difficult subject. What do you think? Get in touch. Call us on country code 44 20 70 83 72 72. Or you can text us on country code 44 77 86 20 60 80.
Hello, I'm Usman Amjad from Pakistan, and you're listening to BBC's World Have Your Say, where we set the agenda.
But first, let's talk cyber wars. The head of the CIA recently said that the next Pearl Harbor could be a cyber attack. Governments around the world are rushing to improve their defences. South Korea is the latest. And many big companies have been attacked too. Sony, Lockheed Martin, even the IMF. But how do cyber attacks compare with other threats like pandemics and conventional wars? And how worried should we really be? Well, let me first of all introduce a few guests we have with us here in the studio. Brian Spector, who is the CEO of Certivox, a company providing information security. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
On the line, Professor Peter Summer from the London School of Economics, who's co-authored a report on cyber security. Welcome, Professor. And in Islamabad, Kamran, who's an internet activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a pressure group looking at civil liberties on the internet. And you can also catch him at his blog, inspirated.com. Kamran, welcome. Let me ask you each first, if I may, and perhaps we could start with you, Brian. We're talking about cyber attacks. What exactly do we mean?
It can really range from, as you've seen, coordinated state-sponsored or state-funded attacks on RSA security, which is, for the listeners out there, in effect kind of a lock maker on secure installations by enterprises and governments on how they can get into their systems. RSA manufactures a lot of the key tokens that safeguard those systems. They were hacked, and as a result of that, that was parlayed into three separate attacks on Defense Department contractors. So it can mean anything on that scale to down to the level where it appears that the Blue Army out of China targeted Gmail accounts of U.S. State Department officials, presumably to parlay that into some other kind of attack, hoping that maybe sensitive information was leaking into personal email accounts or could be leveraged that way.
Professor Summer?
You asked an interesting question right at the beginning, Jill, which was, should we be calling these things cyber war? Now, to my mind, if you're going to use the word war, then whatever you get in the cyber world ought to look rather like what you get in the conventional world. In other words, large amounts of destruction, lots of people dying. And on the whole, we don't see that. It's probably rather more convenient to talk about cyber weaponry, another means by which states and sometimes called sub-state actors can express their means. One of the things that worried me about the way Brian was describing it is, first of all, he seems to be extremely certain that he knows who has been attacking. Says the Chinese did this, other people did that. The big characteristic of this whole area is that very often we don't have any certainty about how these attacks take place. And another
Professor, let me interject there, because let me get a point in. I did not actually mentioned who is behind it. If you actually look at the press release, Google has actually named the Blue Army out of China as being behind those attacks on the Gmail accounts. That wasn't me. And as far as the other attacks that have been concerned, I never named a name there. So, thanks.
Brian, if you're talking about the Operation Aurora back in 2009, Google related those with the Chinese hackers, but the Chinese government firmly denied that those hackers were related with the Chinese government. So they were not state-funded per se, but they were related to China.
So. Yeah, so I know, Cameron, I'm talking about the attacks about 2 weeks back.
This is a fundamental problem, though, isn't it? It is sometimes hard to know who's involved.
It's a critical feature. It's called the problem of attribution. The main technical reason is that only an idiot carries out an attack from their own computer. There are at any one time millions and millions of computers that are available to be taken over and hijacked, so that the attack comes from there. We go briefly back to China, about 400 million PCs there. If we accept, say, that 99% of those are perfectly well protected, every technical measure, the users are not susceptible to any type of social engineering, you're still left with 4 million personal computers in China alone, which are available to be hijacked from anybody anywhere in the world. And that's the problem. And that's why a lot of the talk that you get from military circles, that we can respond by means of conventional military deterrence, really is nonsense. The whole paradigm of how you defend a nation state has to change towards resilience, how you stop an attack happening, but also how you're going to recover from it also. And that's the really big policy debate at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with the professor on this point, actually. I think what's really critical right now is for the Western democracies to step up with their intelligence agencies and start democratizing the tools that they use to protect our own intelligence infrastructure and putting that into the hands of the citizenry, in effect, arming the citizenry. And there are tools that can be made freely available to do that, and certainly guidance can be issued from the likes of folks at CESG into the citizenry to in effect, almost educate the populace as how you can better protect yourself. But on that point, I do agree with the professor.
Kamran in Islamabad, what do you think?
Well, I agree with the professor on the point that the level of motivation for attackers is directly related with the level of sophistication of their attacks as well as their protection. They have all the measures. They have millions of computers they could hijack and use, and they could use other cryptographic measures such as Tor to protect themselves. But when we are going after groups like Anonymous and arresting teenagers in Netherlands, such as that 16-year-old guy, and they are not really the ones who constitute a threat to cyber world or who can be related to cyber war. The hackers who are really dangerous or who have really evil intent, such as the Blue Army mentioned by Brian, they know how to protect themselves really well. So in that regard, we should educate, our users to protect themselves online well and to reveal as little information as possible. But as far as going after the hackers directly is concerned, it is not really possible when a major threat is concerned. When it's about groups like Anonymous or Lulzhack, it's possible. But when it's about Blue Army or state-funded hacking, it's not really possible.
Let me bring in a couple of comments, because they do relate to this whole issue of who exactly is doing the hacking. Pranjal in Andhra Pradesh in India posts on Facebook, Chinese hackers have tried to enter Indian defence networks in the past. It's even been said that they know how to attack European Union-made satellites and infect them with viruses. And a comment by Larry Greenmeyer, he writes on the Scientific American website, saying, cyber warfare is more likely to reflect the wars fought against shadowy terrorist networks such as Al-Qaeda, as opposed to conflicts between uniformed national military forces.
Well, I actually agree with a bit of that and wholeheartedly disagree with the professor. He's looking to actually equate conventional warfare and compare that as an apple-to-apple to a cyber war. I don't really think there is much that you can define about a cyber war, except that it's up to now been a sort of a low-grade intensity conflict, if that's the only allegory that you can make over to a conventional war. But I think what is important is that the citizenry, like any other war that takes place, is usually the easiest target and the most likely portion of the population to be abused in any conflict. They're non-combatants, and that's what really is a big concern for researchers like us out in the field right now.
Brian, actually, I agree with you and slightly sort of misquote or misunderstand my own position. I like precision in language. I think if you use the word cyber war, that creates certain sort of expectations, and I prefer to talk about cyber weaponry. In other words, the various sort of techniques and technologies which are available to actors and non-state actors. I personally think that Louis Panetta is quite wrong in thinking that cyber weaponry alone has the capacity to cause a great deal of destruction. I do think that it's very helpful in what you call low-intensity operations. I also think it's very important in a force multiplier situation. And what I mean by that is where you have an existing conventional attack of one sort or another, and you make it much more effective by disrupting the communications capabilities and the infrastructure, the electronic infrastructure of your enemy. So that's really my vision of it. And I suspect we're not all that far apart on that.
No, I think we've got a case of cross semantics, as you would say. So, absolutely agree with that.
Let me bring in Robert Schifrin, who is on the line in the UK. He's an internet security consultant, but is himself a former hacker. Welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Thank you for waiting so patiently. What do you think so far of what you've heard?
Whether we call it cyber war, whether we call it cyber weaponry or whatever, we're certainly in the midst of a prolonged and quite furious, quite keen battle at the minute, with some major hacks having gone on in the past month or so against some big multinational companies. Sony, I think, started it off and kicked the ball rolling by declaring war on the hackers. And even worse than that, or even more dangerous than that for Sony, is declaring 3 weeks later that they've managed to fix it and that they've won, which is a very, very dangerous thing to do in war, because then the hackers make it their duty to prove that actually Sony hasn't quite won. But it's also worth remembering that the value of information and the value of data during warfare is nothing new. It goes back, you know, a long way. We could talk about Bletchley Park and the UK and American and other nations who cracked the German Enigma codes back in the Second World War. So the value of information and how that compares to normal war is nothing new.
Robert, I introduced you as a former hacker. What exactly did you do?
I was a hacker about 25 years ago in the UK, getting into computer systems. It's important, anybody who protects computer systems for a living has to realise that people break into it for a number of reasons. And it's important to realise that, because the way you protect yourself will vary. It may be you have a disgruntled employee, it may be you have some political activists, it may be you have people who don't agree with the way you do business, it may be that it's organised crime trying to get in, and all sorts of people trying to break into systems. I was simply an interested student, 20-year-old student or so, trying to get into systems for a bit of fun, a game, if you like, of me against the machine. And in the days when I was doing it in the UK, it wasn't illegal. I was involved in a very large test case. It went all the way to the House of Lords, the Supreme Court, as it was in those days in the UK. And what they said is that what I had been charged with by the police, which was actually forgery, it doesn't cover computer hacking. And so they brought in a new law in the UK called the Computer Misuse Act of 1990, which makes computer hacking illegal now in the UK. When I was doing it, it wasn't.
Your description of it as a game against the machine makes it sound quite innocent. And at the other end of the spectrum, we're talking about government against government hacking. It's a huge range, isn't it?
There are those two ends of the spectrum and everything in between. And woe betide any security manager and CISO and whatever these people like to call themselves nowadays, who are responsible for computer security within companies and within governments. Woe betide anybody who doesn't realise that there are lots of different people trying to get into their systems, all of whom need protecting against in very different ways.
Let me bring in Aylin, who's on the line from Istanbul. Welcome to the programme. What's
Hello.
Your thought on all this?
Right. I'm a bit worried about cyber attacks in the sense that it could potentially increase state monitoring over the internet. Obviously, this is from a Turkish perspective, because as a Turkish citizen, I was a bit worried about this, because in the last week, internet monitoring was a hot issue in Turkey. As you may know or may not, there were mass protests against the law which will enable the state to filter what people can access on the internet by means of introducing a so-called optional package for users who are concerned by viewing, again, so-called dangerous material on the internet.
Aylin, that's a very good point, and one that a couple of other people have also made in contacting the programme. Gregory has posted on Facebook saying this is just more propaganda to give them an excuse to take control of the internet and silence dissent. I'm wondering, given that you're concerned, do you have a question for our guests?
Well, I don't really have a question, but I just have a point to make from, again, like, as a concerned Turkish citizen, I just like to state that this could further aggress, I mean, in the case of Turkey, because there was a very recent operation against Turkish government websites by Anonymous, as you may know. I just think this could further aggress the Turkish government, who's already quite suspicious with its stance against internet freedom. That's all I have to say, really. I'm a bit worried.
Kamran, yeah, in Islamabad, could I bring you in? Do you have any concerns?
I would agree with Ellen and Greg here that this whole term cyber war, it is kind of exaggerated, and it's a hyperbolic catchphrase which is just there to make people afraid. I mean, just as Orwell predicted in 1984 that wars are there to take away civil liberties, and I don't think cyber crime is serious enough to constitute a war. So I kind of agree in that regard with the professor as well. So that's my point.
I think that whatever semantics you apply to the phrase, the caller had a point in that governments that are unscrupulous or unethical will try and take advantage of these situations in order to consolidate their grip on power. But what the citizenry can do is get educated to the tools that are at their disposal. If you're worried about privacy, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, there are other groups out there that are battling for your rights and that need support. But the citizenry really needs to get educated to tools that they can use, like encryption, for instance, and start utilizing and protecting their own information. Because if you make it unavailable to the folks that are monitoring the internet in your home country, then they cease to have power over you. And that's a pretty important tool that anybody can use right now. And I would encourage people out there to use it.
We're getting a lot of comment coming in on the blog and on Facebook. R. Niang in Kenya is posting on the blog saying, if someone sabotaged the operations of the New York Stock Exchange, causing an economic crash, for me that does constitute an act of war. Instead of flying Lancasters over Dresden, the agents here are using botnets to take down a vital part of the economy. And Justin in Germany posted on Facebook, the Iranian nuclear program has been rumoured to have been a target of this. I think it's more useful to think of as covert operations. Robert, it brings us back to this idea of it being similar to conventional warfare.
Yes, it does. And I think we should remember that the internet, as well as being the greatest modern tool that the protesters now have in the world, it's also the greatest tool that law enforcement has, because it's much, although it's difficult to trace somebody who misuses the internet or who hacks or whatever, it's much easier to trace them by the internet than it is if they hadn't used the internet. So it's a tool for both sides.
Let me bring in David, who's in Massachusetts. David, I believe you're a veteran of the Vietnam War. What do you make of this comparison between cyber wars and a real war?
Well, it seems to me that in the 21st century, we're more likely to be attacked with keyboards than we are to be attacked with missiles and traditional weapons. That our enemies, whatever those, however we define them, are out to just cause pain. And I think the idea in America, we're still very tied into the military-industrial complex and building equipment to fight the Cold War, when, as we all know, that ended quite a while ago. I hope, and I don't know, but I hope that our government and our military and our intelligence agencies are arming us against possible cyber wars.
We're getting a couple of people asking how you can do that. A question from Nathan in Texas saying, what exactly would a government do to fight these hackers? Someone enlighten me. And Ellie has posted on Facebook to say, individual citizens will never be able to protect themselves. It's the role of governments and service providers whom individual citizens pay to protect the citizenry. How do people protect themselves from hacking?
Well, for one, you need to safeguard and be diligent with your own personal private information, and that includes monitoring what you put on Facebook or social networking sites or any other place where you're utilizing and posting that data to the internet. What most people don't realize is that when you send an email, for instance, it's like the electronic version of not putting a letter in an envelope. It's the electronic version of putting a postcard in the mail. Where anybody along the delivery chain can just read it openly. So when we talk of educating the populace, it's those types of things where you really cannot, maybe I'm too American on this, you really cannot rely on the state to protect you and your family. You have to take an active role in learning about what's out there that you can do yourself to safeguard that data. And that's the first step.
I think Brian's quite right there. One of the things that is happening as a result of cyberspace in general is that the nation state is becoming progressively weaker. It's not coming to an end imminently, but it's one of the features that is diminishing what the state can actually deliver for you, because cyberspace doesn't work on geographic boundaries. And as a result, you really have got to take responsibility and learn how to protect yourself. You need to remember that 80-85% of what you need to do is actually extremely easy, possibly even more, possibly even a higher percentage than that. Don't sit around waiting for governments or police or the army or intelligence services to protect you. In the first instance, the person who has control over your computers, your computing facilities, is you.
David,
well, I would like to go back to that comment which said that citizens cannot protect themselves against these kind of things, and I would like to rephrase it as citizens alone cannot protect themselves from these kind of things, because as the old saying goes, a chain is as strong as its weakest link, and in this chain anyone can be the weak link, including the government, the ISP, or the citizen himself. It's like I can use Tor and all those encryption technologies to access my email on my ISP, but if my ISP is the place where security is breached, I would lose all the confidentiality of my email. So anyone alone cannot protect all this system, and we need to have a collaboration among the governments, the ISPs, and the citizens, and we need to move together.
David in Massachusetts, what are you trying to get in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one last comment, and most of the discussion that I've been hearing was about protecting the individual and our individual websites or emails and information, but it seems to me the bigger fear I have is not protecting my own individual freedom on the Internet. It's the concern of state terrorism, that the bigger picture, like the Iranian, the Israeli attack against the Iranian nuclear program.
The Stuxnet virus is what you're referring to, yes.
Right, yeah. That kind of attack, that kind of warfare, whatever we call it. They could hack into our nuclear weapons or our electric grid or our infrastructure is so tied to the Internet now that it seems that inevitable that eventually somebody's going to find a way in there.